Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ladies and gentlemen, oh, that wasn't very good. I'm out of speed. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I was so worried about changing the venue that I forgot how to speak. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Bedford in Balham. Please welcome a man who is returning to his birthing place to spawn. So watch out, ladies. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Oh, I thought when the lights went out, I thought that was a bottle of rosé champagne there that was on the table. Oh, what a shame. Well, hello, my fine friends. It's lovely to be back in Balham. Welcome to Richard Herring's London South Transmission podcast. Though I was talking to Dave and Sheila from Goblin's Wine Bar that closed down. It was on Bedford Hill. Closed down 20 years ago. They're probably both dead now. They were fantastic, though. They called it Rahulastabad. I don't know if that's gonna. Goblins was an amazing place. We used to go there. Anyone remember Goblins? God, you fuckers. Balham's fucking changed. It was proper and authentic back when I was in. Then when all the middle class people moved in, I had to move out. but Goblins was an incredible place. Dave from Goblins used to challenge you to play Scrabble, and if you could beat him, you got a free drink. But I was the only person who could beat. I beat him consistently. He had cheating rules, and he said when he died, he wanted to be stuffed and put on the staircase. But unfortunately, the venue closed down. The place closed down. It's been replaced. Like all good things. I did write a sitcom about him called Absolutely Scrabulous, but it's. Like everything, it never got made. I was trying to remember some things about Balham, and I can't remember anything, so I must have been drunk the whole time. I used to gig here, but I remember once I came to a party here. It was Terry Johnson, the playwright's party. You know Terry Johnson? He wrote some plays. And some really good ones. And Alison Steadman was here, and Peter Bainham bet me £100 I wouldn't do Bohemian Rhapsody in karaoke. And I did it, and it was terrible. It's really hard to do that on your own. and he never paid up. So that's all I remember about it. I remember about living in Balham. I remember Peter Bainham. After I came back from my granddad's funeral, we used to share a house, which I should say, so we were in the same flat. And he came into the kitchen and said, "I'm delighted that your grandfather is dead." That is my main memory. Terry Johnson actually lived above us, on the flat above us. And his washing machine once overloaded and flooded our flat. That's all I remember about Balham. I remember a girl who used to work on the till in Sainsbury's. She'd always flirt a bit with me, and I'd flirt with her, but I was too shy to ever do anything. And the final day I went and said, "Oh, I'm going back to Northern Ireland today. I'm going back to university, and this is the last day I'm working here." I didn't ask her out. It was obviously said, we should have gone for a drink, right? I could have been married to her. I'm the fucking terrible family I've ended up with. So if that girl's listening, I'm sorry I didn't ask you out. Looking back, it was so obvious that we should have, just banged. That's my main memory of Balham. I did play the Balham Banana, which is a fantastic club, as you know, which is in this very venue. I have a very unusual memory of my first foray into stand-up comedy from 1990, where I didn't have many successful gigs, but I did the upstairs venue here. You do both venues, and I closed the upstairs venue and got an encore, which I don't think has ever happened in the rest of my career. And I was so early in my stand-up career, I didn't have any other jokes to do. So I think I managed to do something else. So that's my Bob Mills, who was on a fantastic comedian at the same time, said to me, "Never be funnier than me again." And I never was, Bob. So thank they. There you go. I should say, just this for people in the room, you've all got a program there which is a free program. What I do at these shows occasionally is I make a collection for Scope at the end. If you feel that program's worth something, there's a bucket on that plinth there. You can put some money in. It doesn't really work anymore because no one carries money with them anymore, do they? But, it's only disabled people having no food. So, that's... Don't worry about it. And I will be at the back, at that table at the back, if you want to say hello or have a photo or autograph afterwards. I will be selling copies of some of my books, How Not to Grow Up, Emergency Questions. You can ask your own emergency questions. Would you rather, suitable for all the family, apart from one... Oh, no, it got cut out. There was one question where it was something like, would you rather be in a flood or be sucked off by a tornado? But they wouldn't let me... They wouldn't let me put that one in. My editor thought it sounded rude. I said, "Oh yeah, no, I didn't realise." And the problem with men as well. Very soon, I haven't got copies of this yet because it's not out yet. You will be able to purchase my new book, "Can I Have My Ball Back?" An hilarious memoir about cancer and losing a testicle. It's quite good. So please do buy that online. You can get it from Go Faster Stripe, and you can get a small puppet of my testicle as well, if you want, from gofasterstripe.com. Oh, okay. Let's crack on. It's lovely to be back in Balham anyway, and I will spawn here if I can. So if anyone's interested in being spawned upon. I mean, it's an afternoon gig, isn't it? So this sort of stuff is not... It's not appropriate. My guest this week... It's 3 o'clock. Is it 3 o'clock? Yeah, when it's 3:10 on a Saturday afternoon for you people listening at home. It's a strange time to do a podcast, but we'll see how it goes. My guest today, you know her. She's probably best known for playing Perun in Xenoblade's Chronicle 2, which I'm sure is why most of you are here. Play that. So get a video game. Will you please welcome the amazing Ria Lina, ladies and gentlemen? It's amazing. Ria Lina. Really. Hello. That mug is for you. You can keep that. You can take that home.
He just said to me, "There's a mug on stage," and I went, "I'm still going to call you Richard." Hello, Julia. Thank you.
It's all right. It's all you're getting. it's not actually. Welcome. What? Tell us about for people who don't play Xenoblade's Chronicles 2.
I can't believe you don't play Xenoblade Chronicles 2.
I don't. I haven't.
Did you stop at Xenoblade Chronicles 1?
I did.
That's enough for me.
I thought to me they'd done enough. They'd done the whole thing.
And they hadn't even found Perun yet. You didn't get her till 2.
Okay.
I don't know. It was obviously a voiceover gig because it's animated. And it's on the Switch. And at the time, the Switch was, I think, the latest Nintendo handset that had just come out. So I did this, and boy, my sons are lucky, because being the narcissist that we all are in this business, I went, well, I have to know what I am in this game. I have to, like, we have to get me. So my children got a Switch, and I just went, here's the Switch, here's the game, find me. and now now whenever they miss me, they play Xenoblade.
Did you did you get killed in that? I mean, probably you die in some versions of it, or do you survive?
No, well, see, my understanding of the game, because this is not my forte, as soon as you become a parent, as you know, you no longer are allowed to understand things like that.
No.
Is that you are whoever you are, the protagonist, and you go through, and there are special blades that you can get, but the blades are also personified, so she's one of the. I know that Perun's one of the harder blades to get.
Yeah,
you got to work for me.
Is it hard to personify a blade? Is that a difficult? Well, was that a difficult acting job?
We were dubbing over the original Japanese, okay. so the way that we had to speak was quite similar. They wanted that kind of ethereal fairy like sound.
Yeah,
but also you had to fit what are quite long, clunky English words into very short Japanese spaces.
Yeah.
So, you know, instead of that, you will find the magical diamond on the mountain. You will find the magical diamond on the mountain.
Good. I quite like to talk to you about just this for the next hour.
You were really testing my knowledge of Nintendo video games.
It would be difficult. It would be a difficult thing to do. Look, there's so much to talk to you about. I can't believe we haven't had you on the podcast already.
Me neither. And on a train strike, it's almost like the day of it. Thank you all, by the way. I love you all for crawling your way here. I mean, where did you come from? Streatham.
Wow, that's a long way.
See? She started walking literally an hour or two ago.
Even Streatham's quite nice now. That's how much things have changed. I mean, before, you'd have been in a different profession if you'd lived in Streatham. I miss the ladies from Bedford Hill. That's all I'm saying. Wait. So I'm just saying that everyone in South London is a sex worker. That is what I'm implying.
Is that what you were referring? It was either that or they work for the NHS because it's also terribly paid.
Thank you for coming, everyone. And it is lovely to be in this shithole. It's a fantastic thing to be. I'm quite interested in this as from a comedy background because I've had a lot of guests on who have lived a life where, and this is something because Robin Ince wrote a great book about why comedians become comedians. But I've had a lot of people who who were born in one place and grew up in another place and have a sort of from everywhere and sort of from nowhere as a result. Because you're British.
Is this a question or you asked me to go back where I came from? I'm not sure where that is.
I'm saying I wonder if there's something about being a sort of outsider and able to view everything from a different perspective. Someone like Phil Wang, who's, you know, and Pierre Novelli, who grew up in different places, then moved and so never quite belonged, but were equally able. So you were born in Britain.
I love Phil Wang, but he very much belonged in Cambridge. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I love him, but
both
listen
of them
to him.
Do
like,
belong
like,
to
yeah,
Cambridge.
They do.
Your parents are German and from the Philippines, so it's quite...
She's American.
Right.
She's ethnically Filipino. Okay. But she was actually, interestingly, adopted after the war by a GI.
Okay.
Who then brought her back to the States.
Okay.
So, I mean, we can fry Spam like the best of them, but my adobo is not as good as it should be.
But you went to school in the Netherlands?
Yes.
In an American school?
In an American school in the Netherlands.
What I'm saying is...
That makes sense.
That's quite a confusing...
Yeah, it ended up being, and that's the thing about my childhood. Some childhoods, you know it from the beginning. If your parents are diplomats or, you know, you work in the military, you know that you're going to be moving every couple of years. But every time my parents moved, they thought that was it. They were like, we're settling. And I think in some ways that made it even harder is to go, okay, we're not settling. And then we'd get up and we'd move. And then we're settling. And then we'd get up and we'd move. But I think you're right. It does, I mean... comedy is about speaking a universal truth, and I guess by moving around, you see those universal truths to be able to then say it back again. And the beauty of comedy in Britain, and comedy is so rich in Britain, I love it. The beauty of comedy in Britain is that the Brits love to hate themselves, so it's really easy to go. You know, it's there's a nice there's a great whereas Americans don't. Nobody's laughing right now. This is bad. They're either all American, except for the woman from Stratum. But you know, but we do. Brits are very good at laughing at themselves and going, yeah, we do that. And you know, and everywhere in Britain's a shithole by their own admittance. You know, it doesn't matter where you go, Stratum, it's a shithole. Balham, it's a shithole. That's all it is. Whereas in the States, it's the exact opposite. Yeah. We just go, woo, I'm from Alabama. Woo, so's my brother, uncle. Woo. So it just means that I think there's a lot of wonderful places to go with comedy in Britain because the audiences are so forgiving and understanding about it. And yeah. And there's intelligence too, actually. I need the intelligence there.
But also, I think when you've seen different cultures, I think it suddenly strikes you how ridiculous any culture is, right? Everything, a culture is in itself is this set of rules and behaviours that if you then have lived in four or five different cultures, you go, well, this other culture has a completely different view of whatever. You
and
know,
so. Thus, xenophobia was born.
Well, but
yeah, it's true.
Well, no, once you've seen lots of different...
Sorry.
Sorry. Right. Once you've seen lots of different countries and different backgrounds, then you sort of realise the idea of being sort of patriotic is sort of insane. That's the insane thing. So the idea of being racist or the idea of thinking, oh, Britain's the best, the UK is the best country in the world, and we should be completely on our own because we'll be great. It'll go really well.
I think we're definitely justifying why we should be on our own right now. I'm not sure if it's because we're doing things the best right now. But yeah, no, it is exactly that. But I think that's why it's important to be able to laugh at yourselves. Otherwise, it does become a little bit rude or a little bit racist or a little bit xenophobic. But there is something about being on the outskirts of all of those cultures, and yet I'm familiar but not familiar. I'm British. I was born here, and my parents thought we would stay here, and then we didn't stay here, and then we came back, and then we were British again, and then we moved, and then I wasn't. And you know, and so there is something about being on the outside and yet being on the inside. Everything is familiar to me. Britain is familiar to me. This is home. But Holland is familiar to me, and that is home. And I don't, you know, I read Dutch signs the same way I read English signs, and my brain doesn't go, we're in a different language. I just know what it is and know what it means. So in some ways it's great because you have this familiarity and you can really understand something from the inside out. But on the other hand, I don't know what's different because it's all familiar to me.
Yeah.
So ironically, the place that I feel most foreign is the US. Okay. Scares the shit out of me. It does, and I'm allowed to be there. As an American, I'm also allowed to be in the States, but I feel so foreign there and scared, and I'm worried about being searched for goodness knows what when I go through the airport. I got searched once by a dog, not like internally. that's a different paywall. But I got searched. But the dog came and was really interested in me, and I was so freaked out because you know the men are they're scary and they're carrying multiple guns and there's no apologies and there's no wiggle room. You've obviously done something wrong because the dog has said. And it was just that I still had a ham sandwich in my bag from the plane. That's it. And the dog was hungry.
You think they'd be trained
like,
to
feed
avoid
your dog?
Yeah,
feed your God.
That's no good if an airport dog is attracted to ham. That's no good. That's going to make things very difficult. I just wonder if they're, you know, Robin Ince's book was so fascinating about comedians and where they come from, and a lot of it is about a childhood trauma, like someone dying or I think like having a parent in a figure of authority. And I just wondered if there's something about not having the security of knowing, you know, of knowing your... You live in one place as a child. I wonder if that pushes you towards comedy, or do you think you would have gone towards comedy anyway?
No, I don't think I would have definitely have gone towards comedy. I have an Asian mom and a German dad. That was not an option.
Yeah.
You know, that and vegetarianism are the two things that I am not allowed to indulge in. Could you imagine if I came home and said I'm a vegetarian? Oh, my goodness. Between my two parents, they can eat an entire pig just from nose to tail. They just meet in the middle like some weird scene out of Lady and the Tramp. If I came home, oh, anyway. But it wasn't a career option.
No.
I think I fell into it, and I fell into it the same way that so many of us did when you try living real life, the way you all do so well, by the way. Can I just say, round of applause for all of you for doing real life. And then it just didn't work, and I kept failing at real life. And then you go to comedy, and you get on stage, and you say all the things that are getting you sent to HR every day, and you go, oh, okay, now I'm where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then you go to HR the next day and quit.
So. But you were very clever and very qualified. So you must, you know, you
for comedy?
No, for the real world. You had PhDs and you'd worked.
I would argue that doesn't. I mean, many. Have you met Mensa? I mean, there are a lot of people there that are not qualified for real life. I had a number of degrees, but again, I was ahead all the time in school, and moving about in schools meant that I was shifting systems and shifting years. So I think I ended up finishing high school at 16, and you kind of get to the end and go, oh, whoops, I did that too fast. And then there's nowhere but forward. You can't like go back and do more high school if you've finished high school. So then, you know, I think I did the PhD because I finished my undergrad at 19 and went, I'm not ready for real life yet. This isn't fair. So yeah. I went and did a PhD, and school is safe. Education is safe. You've got, you know, you go to school, you do your homework. Someone goes, well done. They give you a sticker. It's a wonderful world. So I think that's why I stayed in education for so long. But I don't know that by the time I got to the end of my PhD, I was doing comedy. And right. that was a choice. And then again, if you're presented in your 20s with the option of working 20 minutes a day or 10 hours a day, what are you going to pick? You're obviously going to pick 20 minutes a day, which isn't actually 20 minutes a day. It turns out, as a stand-up comedian, you run an entire business. So you are marketing, and you are accounts, and you are admin, and you are everything. But they don't tell you that. They're just like, 20 minutes a day.
Well, it's become more... I mean, you started sort of 20 years ago, basically, as a stand-up. And I think in those 20 years, things have changed an awful lot in terms of you are a business, and you do have to... Which you're amazing at is understanding social media. You're fantastic.
I'm looking at someone who is equally younger than me to IMTU and just going, look at how much they understand social media. And they're looking at someone in their teen. Yeah. The number of times I turn to my children and go, I don't understand the thing. I want the puppy ears. I want the puppy ears, you know.
But you use it very well. So you use Instagram particularly well, I think. And that you obviously,
you've really stalked me.
I have,
you?
Of course.
This is intense. He has... Really? Okay.
I think it's called research when you're interviewing someone. I think it's allowed. But I do follow you on Instagram, and you're always posting little... So you must... You're always posting little videos of you being, as you are, very witty and sharp in ad-lib bits of... Or where things have gone wrong in gigs, or where... You know, which I think is a brilliant idea, because you're not giving away very much material, but you're showing how funny you are.
That's interesting you say that, because yes, so I love those bits. Those are when I used to watch comedy before I became a comedian, my favorite bits of the show were the bits that were never going to be repeated again. Mm-hmm. Were the bits where the comedian spoke to the audience, or something went wrong, or heaven forbid there was a fight. That was exciting. I love those. So I love posting those bits on social media, but it's actually quite, you know, it isn't as simple as it looks. Like you just cut it out and stick it on there and go, look what happened. But what's interesting is it's about what's in the room. That magic happens in the room. And often I'll watch a video back excited going, oh, that was a great bit. And when I watch it as a video, go, oh, actually, if you weren't there, if I don't, you know, there's not enough context, it doesn't make sense. So it's really nice when I do find a bit that I can go, I can share this with people, because there aren't that many of them that you can then... You know, it is. You had to be there in order to appreciate it.
Well, that's where stand-up is the best thing, you know, and that's where there are gigs, and they don't come along all that often, where just something completely different and magical happens, and you know that everyone in the room will remember it, hopefully for a while, but equally, if you tried to explain it to anyone outside, it would, or showed them, it wouldn't be the same thing, because you there's an atmosphere and electricity... And something exciting happens, but you know. But equally, you can pull things out of it sometimes. Which I think those. But you point at things where they've gone wrong. There's a bit where you talk to a guy in the audience, and he's got a lisp, and he says his name's Sid, but with a lisp, and you think his name's Thid, and that's quite.
But that is what he said.
But it's quite good of you to put that up, because that's a joke against yourself. It's funny.
In my defense, this is when you host a comedy night and you meet, especially, you know, now we're so multicultural. When you meet somebody, you're going to take their name as they say it, because that's how it's pronounced often in there. If they come from another country, if they have another culture. So I will repeat back exactly what I've been said, A, to make sure I got it right, B, so that the rest of the room can hear it. And his poor parents didn't know when they named him. that he'd have a speech impediment. But bless him, he was such a lovely guy. And he sits in the front row, and he loves comedy. Yeah. And he sits in the front row. And this was the first time I'd met him, but afterwards they told me, no, it was fine. And yeah. he was, you know, obviously confident. And that's part of hosting. Part of hosting a show is to try and gauge who does wish to be spoken to and who's very much not wishing to be spoken to and has been dragged to sit in the front row by the people that they're with against their will. and so he was very open, but his name was Sid. Sid, if you're listening, I apologize again. Thank you so much for taking that so well. But he did. He just went, my name's Thid. That's what he did say, Thid. And it could have been, you know, could have been short for anything. You know?
It could have been. Well, I think you've got a very Timkey name in that I think Riolina, I think you could just... I would just run it into one, which people do anyway. But
they do think it's one name.
Yeah,
Riolina.
But I think it should be. I'm like Beyonce, Riolina. I think it's a good Riolina. I'm the only.
Riolina. I wanted to go just by Ria because yeah. it's quite a rare name anyway. I wanted to just be Ria, but when you first start out and you're nobody, everybody's like, "Who do you think you are?" Like Ria, just Ria. So I added Lena. It's memorable. It's amazing. It's short. It's sweet, and it gets screwed up so many times. The number Lena Ria, Rina Rina, Lena Lena Rina, Rina. People still can't get it. How do I? Is it Lina? No. Why would it be Lina? When have you ever seen that being Lina? Have you been to Sweden? It's no.
Look, things have really. I mean, it's interesting to see, because you obviously started in the early 2000s and won lots of awards and did really well, and then I'm guessing you became a mother and the stand-up maybe took a more of a backseat for a little while, but in the last 2 or 3 years things have exploded for you.
Well, so what happened was things were going really well. There was very much a glass ceiling for women mm-hmm. at that time, which I didn't appreciate. Just young and naive, you throw yourself into things. Things go well. It's exciting. But even after, I remember in 1 year, I think I'd done something on every single channel, which sounds amazing. Remember, there were five, and I'd done something. And BBC Three was BBC Choice. Do you remember that? Yeah. Oh, I'm giving away my age. Anyway, so I'd done something on every single channel, and I was knocking on all the doors, and I couldn't even get an agent to sign me.
Right.
Now, I didn't appreciate at the time how many boxes I ticked, and ticking boxes at that time was not a good thing. They did not want you to tick one, maybe. You can tick one. Yeah. But I had an accent, I had ethnicity, and I played a musical instrument, and it was just like the trifecta of doom. which, so strangely, even though everybody was using me, I couldn't, and I sort of hit this ceiling, and I got really, disillusioned.
Yeah.
With it. And of course, what does any woman do when she's disillusioned? She gets knocked up. So I got knocked up. That actually had nothing to do with it. I got knocked up because the man that I wanted to father my children was over 40, and I went, I better get these out quick. You know, because sperm expires. Trust me, see my youngest. Anyway.
And balls fall off, I have to warn you.
Oh, it just fell off. I thought that
it just fell off, rolled
like,
away.
Like a lamb, they just wrapped a little rubber band around it and eventually just, wow, okay, modern medicine. Support your NHS, please, support. I had children, and I sort of, I did that graceful thing of just going, drawing the flowery curtain, going, I will just be having some time to myself, thank you very much. Little realizing how quickly things would progress, because when I pulled the curtain back and went, okay, I'm ready to come back, they all went, who the fuck are you? Like, honestly, who are you? And I had to go back and almost start again.
Yeah.
Because there was just no faith. And it was amazing how many times people genuinely thought that because I'd given birth that my brain had fallen out of my vagina shortly after the placenta. And they just went, well, we're not sure you can do it anymore. And that pervaded for a long time. I don't think it's till recently that we've now trusted women to have babies and a career at the same time, in comedy, at least. Because I had to go back and start again with people that had used me for years. Even pregnant, I was booked and I gigged pregnant, and one promoter said to me, it's like, have you ever considered just wearing like a cushion underneath? You are so funny pregnant. You should just always gig pregnant. And I said, I think it's more to do with the hormones than it is to do with the bump. if I'm honest. But just, yeah, and as soon as I gave birth, it was a trial. Yeah. So I did walk away from, I never quit. I realized that every time I sort of didn't gig for a couple of weeks, I'd get itchy. And if I said I used to be a stand-up comedian, it would hurt. It would hurt so much. So, and then after a small stint working for the Serious Fraud Office, as you do, again, as you do, where you just fall into a job doing fraud investigation for the government, I realized, we've all been there, right? We've all been there. You wake up one day going, what am I doing? Fighting crime. I should be telling jokes on stage 20 minutes a day. And so I came back to comedy and I haven't looked back.
What was the most serious fraud you investigated? You probably can't talk about it.
I have signed the Secrets Act, if they can find me. Oh, wait. This goes out, right? Yeah, okay. No, so
no one listens, so it's fine.
Well, the interesting thing... sorry, I'm just doing a quick thing. This is the thing about the Serious Fraud Office. The Serious Fraud Office is for serious fraud, okay? Serious fraud. Frivolous fraud... The local police can handle that, but we handled serious fraud. But that included, at one point, investigating our own director for mismanaging funds of the Serious Fraud Office. And that, I know for a fact, is public knowledge, so feel free to leave that in. But I worked in the IT. I was an IT forensic investigator, which means that I would do... We'd go on the raids. We would gather the electronics and the computers and the fax machines. Not that I worked there that long ago, but people still had fax machines, and we would have to take the fax machines because there's a tiny little memory card on a fax machine, and there might be half a fax still stuck in there that proves everything. And we're talking about multi-million pound international cases like the BAE case and drug price fixing and things like this, but half a fax might crack it. And we'd go in and do all of that. And then we'd have to, take all of the information off of it and the spreadsheets and the financial data and everything else. But then the last thing that we would have to do is check for child porn. So we'd have to go through and check for child porn, which was, I got very lucky in that I got allocated to the international department, which meant that there was such a high level of security on most of those computers that nobody could sit at work and like download any kind of porn whatsoever. Right. But the last case I did was in a Caribbean country. We went over there and did a raid and came back, and they did not have the same level of security. And I have never seen so many erect penises in my life, just searching through that. And it was the most surreal day at work to have to lean over to the guy next to me and go, does this guy look under 16 to you?
Oh, God.
And then he'd look over and he'd go, no, it's watermarked with a website. It's probably legal. I go, thank you.
Wow.
So I think they were trying to hide that more than the fraud. They probably cared that, if we let anybody know that there was a lot of...
You're not saying that a lot of the rich and powerful people in this world are into underage sex. That's a surprise. That's a surprise to me. And somehow getting away with it.
Yeah,
what?
Yeah. Well, you didn't hear it here first, folks.
But look, you came back to comedy. You studied virology, right? The study of viruses.
That was non sequitur. Yeah. I came back to comedy, but I studied virology long before that.
Yeah,
yes.
But then you came back to comedy big time, and then a massive virus hit.
Are you saying it was my fault?
Yeah. Just a coincidence. Just that's all I'm saying. Did you have something in your pocket that fell out?
Just in case. Well, I've been waiting for years for the Filipinos to do something, because that's usually what happens in comedy, is that something happens and we all go, ooh, something happened in Iran, let's talk to Shappy. Or, ooh, something, happened in Germany, let's talk to Henning Venn. And so the Filipinos weren't doing anything. They just weren't doing anything. So I just went, right, well, I know what to do.
Was there a degree of irony, though, that your comedy career was slightly... halted by a virus after you'd studied viruses?
It was literally the reverse of that. It was exactly because of the pandemic that people started noticing me. Because when everything shut and we all went into lockdown, obviously there was no live gigging or anything else. And I thought, well, what can I do? Well, I can do science communication. Because a lot of my old colleagues that work in labs and are still working in academia and working in virology couldn't speak to the press because of the work they were doing. They weren't able to speak clearly, or it was very risky for them.
Yeah.
But I could, because I had no affiliation. So I started doing things like talk radio and Sky News and going on and go, what's the latest? What's happening with this variant? And doing and literally just doing science communication and talking about what was going on and trying to break it down because there was so much information happening at that time.
Yeah.
And scientists, bless them, I love them, but they're awful communicators. they are, but they do. They just sit there, they get caught in jargon and they're not, they make it scarier than it necessarily needs to be.
Okay.
So, you know, you combine parenting with science communication and go, this is all you need to know. Now swallow the medicine, you know.
Yeah. So it was good for you in the end.
So that I think that
coronavirus
that it's
made you.
Yes.
And you know how to make viruses in a laboratory. So that's all I'm saying.
And if I donate to any bat charities, it's completely coincidental.
Where do you think it came from, bats, or do you think it came out of a Wuhan clinic?
Well, those two are not mutually exclusive,
okay.
Are they?
They aren't.
No. So the Wuhan Virology Lab was well-renowned for going around and collecting samples of viruses from bat caves, not just in China, but all the way around Laos and surrounding areas. And they would keep a repository of the viruses, sort of almost like a library. So could it have been... People keep thinking that lab leak means... The people were working on it and mutating it and turning it into something out of a Marvel comic. It could literally have been that somebody that accidentally released something that was just stored in the library so that it does come from nature, but it was stored in the library and the lab. So those two things can happen. The closest relative, the last time I read this, so please feel free to correct me, but it was that it was most closely related to a virus that had been found in a Laos cave.
Okay.
A cave in Laos. And we still haven't found all of the intermediaries, but I know the origin story is fascinating, but I think just equally as fascinating is the fact that Omicron has evolved so quickly just in the last year to give us all these different variants that are now possibly coming back literally this autumn, that it almost doesn't matter what the origin story was because it's out there and it's still evolving and it's still affecting us and it could still... You know, it can still turn left or turn right and go in any direction because evolution is non-directional, by the way.
Thanks for...
Look at humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're all going to die.
Well, yeah.
Eventually.
But we knew that.
Oh, God. Well, that's a first, that's an exclusive for the... That'll be... The Daily Mail will pick that one out.
Today they chose me to tell you that? Oh, Richard. Okay.
It's fine. But, you know, and you worked in pathology as well? Was that a degree?
No, I studied. I studied pathology.
Okay.
That was... So I wanted to be a forensic pathologist. My two loves in high school... I mean, how did she end up in comedy? My two loves in high school were forensic pathology and viruses. Those were the two things that I loved. I had a wonderful biology teacher. He made me my first mixtape. That sounds worse than it is. Can I just clarify? He was like a favorite uncle as opposed to the weird uncle at Christmas. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're looking weird at me. But you do, come on, you've got that favorite. He and his wife had no children, and he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And he was that teacher for me that made me go, I want to study biology. And then I got to university and went, this was a mistake. It was really to do with Mr. Terry. And I loved him, and so he made the... He was a wonderful teacher who made the subject exciting, and he would share books with me, you know, and give me... He was one of those teachers that just went, here's a side door into the subject. Read this book, instead of just putting things on the board and going, a cell has a nucleus, and I'm like, you know. And so I thought I wanted to be a forensic pathologist, but it turns out you need to go to medical school first for that. And my school was so small, it didn't have chemistry at the right level, so I couldn't go to med school. So I was like, oh, I'll study pathology anyway. Okay. And so I did, and I loved it. And then from pathology, I then narrowed in and focused on viruses because they're amazing. Am I the only... I think they're amazing.
Well, I mean, we're...
Thank you.
We're all more interested in them now they've come to get us.
You know what? I love that everyone understands a little bit better what they are, and I hope that at least in this country, people aren't still asking for antibiotics for them. I'm loving this. What's your name? Hi, Sharon. Did I say that right? Please tell me I said that right. Yeah. Okay. Do you work in science or medicine or nature?
No.
Yes, I know.
Travel through time and space.
To be here.
I know. And to take over
our... Do you like that idea because you think that's true or because... No, okay.
It's a theory. It's a theory.
Well, you know, we're potentially all a virus from space, aren't we? That's the beginning of life could have been us travelling on meteors from somewhere else. It must have started somewhere, though, mustn't it? Might as well have started here.
Why couldn't it start here?
Well, it could have done, but could have come from somewhere else.
Could have happened in two places at the same time.
Could have done. But, you know, there's no evidence, is there? Where is it? Where are all the other space creatures? That's my question to you.
Again, they've looked at us and gone, still stay well clear.
Although
probably,
I think...
probably a bit like goblins.
I think Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, they look like they're aliens inside. If you look at them, they just look like they're aliens wearing ill-fitting human suits. Both of them. Their eyes aren't quite in their eye sockets. It's like they've pulled a hollowed-out human being over their alien form. And that's why they don't really understand what's going on there.
I would think it would explain her speech patterns as well, wouldn't it? As she sort of translates it from alien speak into, pork markets in Beijing. That's some AI gone wrong, isn't it? You know when you get AI to write an article for you and they've just thrown words together and she's gone, I've opened pork markets in Beijing. Cheese!
It is.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Well, look, let's talk about some of the comedy you've done, even though I would like to talk to you about virology forever. How's it suddenly happened, right? In the last 3 years, you've gone from doing a bit of acting and a bit of stand-up and a bit of TV every now and again to sort of being on everything. Everything. Don't you think? You're on everything.
Am I on everything?
Yeah.
I'd love to do Taskmaster. Can I put that out? I'm not on Taskmaster.
I'm sure you'll be on Taskmaster. I'm absolutely sure. And if you're anything like any of my other guests, you've already recorded Taskmaster and just pretend and like myself as well. To be fair. But I'm sure you will be on Taskmaster. I'm hoping Taskmaster will at least go to 2028.
Do you know?
Because then I'll be in the champion of champion of champions. That's if I can live that long.
There's a champion of champions for Taskmaster?
There's a champion of champions. Yeah, I'm the champion. I'm the champion of fucking champions.
Oh, I want
that. I want to be the champion of champions.
You know what? That actually is one of the worst fears as an act is that something will get canceled before you have an opportunity to be a part of it.
Yeah.
I very much want to be in a Star Trek universe before that all goes. I'm the only one. All right. But yeah, Marvel now as well. You just go, I want to be in that.
Well, there's a chance, isn't there?
There's a chance.
Brett Goldstein's in the... Is Hercules in the Marvel universe?
Brett Goldstein is Hercules in one after-credit scene, which if it gets picked up, he will then become Hercules.
Okay.
Which I really, really, really want.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit weird, though, because we're colleagues and I've known him for as long... He was an open spot, an open micer a long time, around the time that I was. It is kind of like watching your brother naked. It's a little bit weird. We just go, well done! Great! No, that was good, but I can't look at it straight. But he's beautiful. He's a beautiful person. So I hope that happens.
I'm sure it will. He's doing okay. He's got a couple of Emmys.
He's doing all right. Yeah, he's written a couple things, hasn't he?
He's done all right. I think
done all right.
couple of TV shows. I think he's doing all right. We're just not here to talk about him.
A couple of awards, hasn't he?
He's done all right.
Holds his mantelpiece down in case of.
Last time I saw him at the Edinburgh Fringe, he had about 45 people in. So I don't think he's doing that well. It was in 2017, but if that's not the...
We have 42, so I wouldn't, talk.
That's what I judge it by. If you're doing as badly as me, then it's not going well.
But then he does have two balls. So.
At least. Yeah, well, you know, hopefully one day they'll cast a Hercules with one ball. That's my dream. I'm now from a minority, so I now suddenly have a little bit of... sway.
You're halfway to womanhood.
And, you know, why has Hercules always got two balls? And they're out. The Cernabis giant is meant to be Hercules.
I like that you're manspreading anyway. Yeah. You know, that's what I like. Get that one ball. Air it. Air it out.
The other one's taken, you know, it's taken up the room now. It's moved in.
Well, that can happen, across. Right? Yeah, like if, you know, people who have to have hemirectomies? What's it called? When you have half your brain out and then the other half
compensates? Let's call it hemirectomies. That's hemirectomies. That's good.
I don't know. When they have half a brain out, the other half of the brain compensates for it. Which is fascinating.
I don't think that's as serious as having one of your balls removed, though. So I think for you to equate losing a ball to someone losing half their brain is frankly insulting
to
the monoball community.
That a lot of men do keep their brains in their balls.
That might explain a lot, actually, now I think about it. What was the impetus, do you think, for, you know, people seemingly suddenly... And it happens to a lot of comedians. And I was saying back, say Chris McCausland, the same thing, worked for 20 years and, you know, a very, very fine comedian, as there are many, many fine comedians on the circuit, as you were, and then suddenly sort of TV catches up. Do you think there was a moment that...
It was the pandemic, because...
But you weren't being funny during the... Where you would... 170,000 people have died, but... And then you'd get a punchline in there. They were all cunts. So it's fine. There were... No...
I think it is about, there's a certain extent it was about backstory, isn't it? It's about what do you bring to the table. We're in a different period of awareness now in terms of diversity, in terms of what people can bring to the table. We're far more conscientious about different voices, different viewpoints.
Yeah.
And do you want to be the TV show that says no to the comedian that's also a virologist in the middle of a pandemic?
No,
right? Who also is a woman? Oh, great. And autistic. And, you know, like, oh, she ticks all the boxes. The rest of the cast can be white and male. Thank goodness. Welcome to Have I Got News for You.
Yeah, but they would do that once, maybe, but they wouldn't have you back three times and more than that, probably, if you weren't doing a good job. So it's as much as that might be a factor and should be a factor, to be fair, because we should be leveling up.
Right, and this is where also Chris has done the same thing, is where when you come in, I think there's a lot, you know, there was a shift. When I first started, if you won a new act competition, you'd won a 5-minute new act competition. They'd be like, well done, you've got 5 good minutes. Now you come back when you've got 20. And they'd keep an eye on you, and they'd help you out, but you just proved that you had 5 minutes. Yeah. And now, if you win a new act competition, they're like, well done, come and be on TV. And it suddenly jumps. And the longevity and the experience that a lot of people on the circuit had from before that would then graduate them eventually to television, suddenly it was flipped. And I found that very strange when I came back to find out that, well, I'm too long in the tooth to redo competitions. So how do I make people aware of who I am? But then when you do finally get booked, you bring with you sometimes 2 or 3 times as much experience as some of your newer colleagues. Not to say that my newer colleagues aren't good at what they're doing, but you can't deny that having more experience, if you're not using that experience, I should say, then what are you doing? Bring it with you. Chris brings it with him. He brings with him a whole bunch of ability.
And I think what's similar about you both, is you really work hard on it. When I've done Have I Got News for You, I genuinely just turn up and sit and see what comes out of my head, and that's why I did it twice in 2010 and have never come back again. But you know, I think Chris did count the Cats Countdown and watched 80 episodes of Countdown so that he could learn. Chris is blind, if you don't know, so he could learn to do Countdown in his head, and so be brilliant at Countdown when it came to do those bits. And you know, I've heard you being interviewed about doing things like Mock the Week and Have I Got News for You, and taking the week off in order to write jokes and study the news, and you know, which I think it shows a sort of level of professionalism that I don't think is fair. And but really counts against lazy people like me.
Have I Got News For You is definitely on that tick list I was telling you about of things that I wanted to do. And as we all grew up with Have I Got News For You. I mean, that started in the dawn of time. And so if there was ever a panic that a show would end before I got a chance to do it, it was that one.
Yeah.
And so it was huge for me to walk onto the set and see the little people that turn the panels. And, you know, and they all have to do it in sync as well. It's really impressive how they do that. And they turn it around once at the beginning, and they turn it around once at the end. They work so hard. But to see all of that and to do all that, but you're sitting next to Ian Hislop, who's essentially on top of the news and has been for 30 years. And my logic was, what am I possibly going to bring to this? Because a flippant joke, like Mock the Week is such a fun show, but it is one-liners. It is set up punchline. You know, what is the answer? Boom, boom, boom. Answer. Scene, caption, competition. But with Have I Got News, it's an in-depth discussion of what's going on with the editor of Private Eye and then a host who has had, you know, had a whole host of writers researching and writing the jokes, and they have this huge stack of cards with all the information on it. You know, what I'm going to just come in and just go, yeah, but look at Liz Truss. She looks like a chicken who forgot how to walk. Or what? You like? I'm not. I couldn't. But I wanted. So that's when I started going, what can I bring that maybe Ian didn't have? So the last thing, the last episode was, you know, during this recent economic turmoil that Liz and Kwasi have wrought upon us, and I had been doing an interview on Times Radio. I was doing Hugh Rifkin's show. And we were obviously rubbishing the economic plan when somebody wrote in and went, excuse me, but Kwasi Kwarteng has a PhD in economics. And I didn't know that. And I was thrown. I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe he does know. I have no idea. But I went away and looked up his PhD and went, nah, pile of shit. Absolute pile of shit. He's an economic historian. If anything, he's a historian. He just happened to focus on something that was vaguely economic, which is the great recordage of 1696, which is where they basically realized that their silver coins weren't worth what they should be worth because people kept chipping off bits of silver and then trickling it down to poor people, I assume. And they're like, oh, hang on, that doesn't work. So they had to gather in all of the silver and remake the coins. And it didn't work. It actually didn't work. So I just thought the irony of the fact that he has a PhD in a failed economic policy was...
And he'll be part of economic history himself now as well.
So you know what?
They'll be studying him for years.
In 100 years, someone will have a PhD in Kwasi Kwarteng. And so the cycle continues and we never learn. But so that was the kind of thing that I thought, I can bring that because I know that, you know, I know what Ian keeps abreast of, and that was a kind of tidbit that I can bring. So that's why I like to kind of look around it and see what can we bring in and how can we look at things differently. And then I sit there with my bits and go, and, you know, I say my three things or my four things. I'm like, I said my stuff. And then he off the cuff just says 15 incredibly funny, erudite things. And I go, fuck you, Ian. I spent a week on this. You waltzed in. No, I really like him, actually.
Yeah, it's an amazing show. It's sort of like they've done it for so long. Mm. In fact, if you don't watch it for a little bit, it's quite unsettling because you've got an image of them in your brain and they're now 10 years older than that image.
Yeah,
and then suddenly go, oh, fuck.
But some of the pictures they use on iPlayer are definitely not from this decade either. Oh, Paul was a brunette.
And Paul has done a clever thing of making himself look quite disconnected and uninterested in the show. It's sort of his bit, which works quite well for him, doesn't it? So it's because it's, I mean, you know, I don't know from, it's a lovely show to do, and it's, but I found it very, both times I found it very intimidating. The second time I did it, I realised we were sort of 5 minutes in and I hadn't said anything yet. And then I was suddenly going, fuck, you know, what if it's 10 minutes in and I haven't said, you know, then suddenly you start panicking because, you know, what if you end up saying nothing? So it's very intimidating to do it.
It is, and I think obviously the more you do it, the easier it gets because you're more familiar. They know you. They, you know, Ian's really great at sort of going, no, you you tell. And he's really wonderful at giving you that space. Because if you identify a story and you're the one who identifies it, if they keep the story in, you stay in the edit. And that's part of it. I think we all know people, especially in the beginning when they started putting women on telly. I remember hearing a story, I think it was about Catherine Ryan, keep the thinking, just in case this isn't, but I think it's about Catherine Ryan not smiling in edits because she noticed that they would use cutaways of her laughing at other people and count that as her screen time. So if you don't smile, then they have to use what you're saying. And I thought that's really interesting because they will. They will cut away to you just laughing at others. Look at this funny man speak. Look at this woman laughing at him. Because he's so funny. And they use that as a reinforcement. So, so he's really nice about making sure that you get time in the edit and things like that. But it also depends on the host and who the other guest is. But there's only five of you, because on Mock there's seven of you. There's seven of you fighting for jokes. And if you think about Dar's going to get more than his fair share, that means that you're each getting less than 4 minutes total, if you're lucky, in the edit. And so everybody's scrambling to try and get something in that's usable. And that can be, it burns a lot of energy because you're just churning through energy. And what did he say? And what have I got that I can say that? What are my jokes? I've just spent 5 days writing jokes. He just said one of my jokes. Okay, what am I going to say now? Oh, he said. And you can end up sitting there just enjoying everybody else being really good at it.
Yeah.
Just going, I think I did Extra Slice at the week. It came out last night. And it was Martin Kemp. Huh. And I sat between Martin Kemp on one side and Ian Sterling on the other, and those two just kept going. I just sat there going, "Yep, wait, no, I'm in this, representing." But yeah, no, you can just sit.
Yeah,
there.
Well, that's the danger with Taskmaster as well. That it's so funny that there's so many of them that a couple of times you sit back and go, "Oh shit, I'm in this." You're sort of just laughing at Greg.
Do you know what? If I never do it, at least I'll have lived it through you.
Yeah. I'm sure you will do it. This is something I didn't talk to Sarah Pascoe on maybe the last podcast, but I didn't notice her talking about it. I've heard you talking about it, and it's something I hadn't really considered, was for female comedians about the way you dress and your image on stage. A, that 20 years ago, until the female comedians sort of really had to dress down for fear of looking too glamorous, which is, and antagonizing anti-women audiences, and then for male comedians, that's not really. I had a brief time where I thought, should I wear a suit on stage or not? Should I just go? And I sometimes wear a suit, and sometimes I just wear whatever I'm wearing. But it's quite a big deal, and especially when you get onto TV, I think, isn't it? It's about the image you're projecting.
It's huge how every time I'm on TV, someone will message me and go, "Where did you get that? Where did you get this? I really liked what you were wearing." The comments on your appearance are almost, that's the other reason to work hard, is to give them enough content to comment on so that they are not commenting on what you're wearing, because you've almost failed if they just go, "You looked nice," which is what my mother does every time. Well, actually, that's very much not true, but every time I do a show on BBC, because they live in the Netherlands, they can only watch what's on iPlayer. So that's all they get to see. So she'll never see Extra Slice, which is why I wore that shirt, because she hates it. But but she will tell me every time what she thought about what I wore, because she's deaf, and for things like Mock, when they throw it up, the subtitles are automated and the subtitles don't match the show. So she can't actually understand or listen to anything that I've said. So all she can do is rip to pieces the way that I looked.
Okay.
But yeah, you do. You get a lot of comment on that. And I remember the first time I got invited, the first show I did of that level was Mock. And it was still in the middle of the pandemic. And I had to just pick an outfit out of my wardrobe, which was horrifying. Everyone who cares about their clothes knows what I'm talking about. Here's an opportunity to shop, and I couldn't, and I'm still scarred by that. So they opened up the shops for 2 weeks for Christmas. Do you remember that? They shouldn't, but they did. And so we went shopping. We shouldn't have, but we did. And my agent and I went around the shops because they asked me to do the one right after Christmas again in January. And we went looking around, and I remember going, "Okay, so what's my style going to be?" And we'd pick something. Oh, what about this? Rosie Jones dressed. No, okay, that's Rosie Jones. And we'd find something else. Oh, that's Carrie Pritchard McLean. And we'd have to put it back. And what about this? Oh, Aisling B. And it was, we're just sort of going, all the styles have been taken,
right,
to go, what are you going to wear? But I'm really inspired, actually. I noticed that she's on here. Aisling B gave you a comment on the problem with men.
Yeah.
I really have been inspired by Aisling B because she's really into sustainable fashion and really staunchly into it. And I realized that that was important to me as well. And so the first couple of times I went out and bought something, and I know for Apollo, I worked with a stylist who bought brand names. But after that, I was like, no, I think I'm going to go vintage and just find secondhand stuff and charity stuff. So as much as I can, I try and find that and then pay. And then you pay maybe 20 quid for something out of vintage, and if it doesn't quite fit, I'll pay the extra 10 or 15 and get it altered to fit me rather than fast fashion. So that's what I'm aiming for.
It's good, but it's also, I mean, I guess this is true of women in business as well, you know, that women have to spend all this extra time thinking about, you know, makeup or appearance or jewelry or how they're going to look, whereas men are just sort of, you know, maybe rubbing a flannel over their balls or ball. Dragging
out. What shows are you doing?
Well, that's why I'm not on TV very much. But
they wear trousers on Have I Got News For You. I know you never see it, but they're all fully trousered up.
In stand-up comedy, right, if you're doing a gig at the Bedford and Balham, nearly every male comedian would just turn up in whatever they're wearing. They wouldn't be spending any of their day thinking about that sort of stuff.
I know that there are a number of comedians that will always, they look like they've just showed up like that, but I know that they'll always wear always a black t-shirt or always a shirt. Jared Christmas always has his wonderful cowboy shirt. So they do, actually, the men do have a style. It just, and that's, I think, testament to how well it suits them that we just think that they've just showed up. But actually, a number of people change clothes when they get to the Comedy Store dressing room. Yeah. Into what they gig in now, male and female.
Sure.
Both do that. In fact, if anything, it's the women that show up ready to go because we have to do all that at home with all of our lotions and potions and figure all of that out. But it's the thing, actually, what I will say, because I hope people who work in telly will hear this, one of the effects of the pandemic, which really irritated me, was they... And obviously, health and safety is important, but they cut down makeup time on TV shows. So you used to go in, and they would give you makeup, and obviously, men probably take about 15 minutes, and they powder the face, and they might highlight a little something, and then the women will take longer because of foundation and everything else that we have to put on. And when the pandemic happened, they, A, started saying, can you just come studio ready? No, I didn't spend 20 years studying makeup. I spent 20 years studying comedy. I have no idea how to put shit on my face and make it look right, okay? Like, it'll look like a Dali painting or Picasso at best. Or they would say, you can have 15 minutes. So if you put your base on, they'll touch you up or they'll do it. And I went, and it's still sometimes now, as a money saver, what they're still saying is, we have hair and makeup, but we've cut the time down. They went, well, we were able to do it in the pandemic. We've cut the time down. I go, that's just plain sexist.
Yeah.
Because there is a higher expectation of us to look a different way. It takes longer for us to get to that point. And cutting down that makeup time also is destroying the hair. You know, hair and makeup artists study for what they do. They study hard. I appreciate every single skill that they have because I can't do it. And to cut that time down or to say you can have as much time as the men go on and it didn't change for men at all, but it significantly changed for women, and that really irritated me that that's still the case.
Yeah,
now
that's a very good point,
places.
And it's a very good point about the makeup artists themselves. I think I've really noticed that is a much lesser role even for men. Often it's just they might leave you a bit of blush, you know, a little bit of powder or something on the desk.
Yeah,
and so you are, you know, men are supposed to going to do it themselves, but obviously don't do anything.
And there was obviously health and safety from their point of view.
Yeah.
At the height of the pandemic, they didn't want to be in someone's face for 45 minutes, and I get that. But there was points where they went, well, we're not having them on set. Because they'll usually come in a break in a recording and, like, powder your face or whatever. They would give me my makeup in a bag and then just say, oh, keep that with you under the desk. I'd be like, why is it going to apply itself? Like, what am I doing? Ian Hislop's going to powder my face and I'll powder his? Like, what are we doing? And then they give it to me there, and then they wouldn't be allowed back. And I was supposed to, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing with this. I don't know what I'm powdering. I don't know where to put it.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting stuff. Yeah, I'm going to ask you an emergency question because I've just Liz Truss here. I've just broken down. Have you ever seen a ghost?
No, but I'd love to.
Okay.
I'm just one of, you know, I'm neither a believer nor a denier because I have no evidence either way.
Okay.
Well, actually, because the absence of evidence does not mean that something is not.
No, that's the beauty of ghosts.
And
what
science.
What kind of ghosts would you like to see? You seem very excited.
Well, yes, I want something well, dare I say tangible? Tangible. Something where, you
like
know...
Like a person.
Well, no, just a definite...
There's
just,
a ghost.
Just a definite experience, yeah, where I can go, that was spooky, or that was, you know, that was, you know, a person walking through a wall or something like that.
That would be it.
But not just a light flashes by, or, you know, those spinning, you know, you see videos of, or just you see videos of things moving unexplained. That would work for me. Or not those, there's like one of sticks, you know, flying sticks, twizzle sticks. And you see videos of these twizzle sticks and they go, those are aliens. And you go, they look like dragonflies. Just really fast, you know. You know, you just don't have your shutter speed.
I haven't seen those videos.
No, they're always black and white and grainy, and they're just like this. I'm like, yeah. I don't believe it. So yeah. I love the videos of things moving. And
okay, do you think that ghosts have bum holes? This is a question posed by my then 4-year-old son.
Do I think they have bum holes?
Yeah, do they have
I think
bum
they
holes?
Have everything they died with.
Do you?
Except for the one ball.
But they don't, because they're see through, so they don't have internal organs. So why would they have an anus if they... If they exist, they're a projection of the outward appearance. And you never
see.
You never see a ghost with its pants off, do you? People must die with their pants off.
Oh, all the time.
But you never see
Especially
a ghost.
In
I
politics.
Mean, you've never seen a ghost, but you never see a ghost with his arse out, do you?
Well, have you ever been to a haunted hospital? Because they don't put backs on those gowns.
No, exactly. I don't know. Maybe they just give the ghost pants. If
they
died naked,
mouth.
They give them special ghost pants.
They have a mouth, and that's just the other end of the asshole, isn't it? It's just
yeah,
one,
but your mouth's visible, isn't it? Your mouth's visible, but your anus is not visible, usually. So well, I would say...
Again, it depends how you died.
And even when it's, you know, even if you're not wearing any clothes, it's the bum cheeks usually... Hide the anus
anyway. Do you think the ghosts end up being more like Ken dolls when they die? So do you think their butt cheeks are like literally one big butt cheek that just has a bit of a seam but not
I
an
do
actual?
Think that, yeah.
Huh. But they're not tangible. You know, like you could put your finger. Okay. Yeah. All right. Fine.
That's why they wouldn't. You know. That's why they close the butthole up. Because if you put your finger in
through,
it.
Yeah. You know, I realized that in my head I was going sideways through the cheeks, sort of skewering them, but everybody else listening would have just gone, why is she sticking her finger like straight through? Yeah, okay. I'd probably use a stick if I'm honest. If I did see a ghost, I wouldn't use my actual hand, but then how could I tell if it was
You'd
cold?
Use a stick. Where would you get a stick from? Has a ghost just appeared? You're looking for a stick.
Okay,
get your fist in there.
Maybe the poker near the fireplace, because obviously we're in a gothic, you know, mansion of some kind.
So you're attacking the ghost with
the
poker?
No, I'm not attacking it. I'm just seeing
That's
it.
That's not the way the ghost's going to see it. Sees a woman coming at him with a poker.
Yeah, but it's coming at me with its
on.
Mouth open screaming.
He doesn't know he's a ghost. He thinks he's still alive.
Well, some of them do, because they want you to leave.
So you're coming at him with a poker. He's going, what's happening?
Wait, you've got a very nice ghost. Well, I've got like a floaty, screamy banshee.
Okay. Even so, they still deserve to be treated with respect.
Do they, though?
Why haven't they gone?
It's the rules on ghosts.
Why haven't they gone to heaven? What's going on? What's wrong with them? Why are they stuck here in this realm?
Some of them obviously are stuck because they have shit to work through and they haven't worked it out. And some of them are just, you know, vindictive.
I've got shit to work through. Do you think that's why I'm still here?
I think you're still here, hon, because you're alive.
You sure? I mean, I wouldn't know. What if I'm a ghost? Okay.
Yeah, you're still here.
I see you didn't use a stick to poke me with. You respect me enough to use your finger.
I did.
Good. You did used to have a ukulele. What happened to the ukulele?
I did.
What happened to the...
I was told to stop playing it because too many... Apparently it confuses TV producers if you can sing. Unless, of course, you're going for like X Factor. But yeah, no, I was just told don't... musical comedy is not viewed favorably across the industry, rightly or wrongly. And so I was just told not to do it. And then I don't know why some people think that if you can sing or write comedy that rhymes, that you therefore cannot talk otherwise. But apparently that's a thing. So if I wanted to do things like Have I Got News For You, I had to not let people know that I also sing.
Okay. But you do cabaret shows, is that right? I've seen you talking about
it. I have done in the past cabaret. Yeah. Annoyingly and unfortunately, the pandemic did obliterate some of our best venues. Café de Paris is now gone. And, of course, that was a historic venue that got bombed during the war. And so many people have played there. And I don't know what's happening with that space, but right. it's no longer the Friday, Saturday night destination venue than it was.
Okay. Your Live at the Apollo was maybe the first time that the public saw your stand-up, which you, and you do talk, you talk about, obviously, your family quite a lot. And you talk about...
Yeah.
You've got... You haven't really, and like some comedians, I think you've mentioned your autism, but it's not like a big part of your comedy.
Yeah, I think I'm probably one of the OG autistic, definitely female comedians on the circuit. So I got diagnosed around 10 years ago or something like that. And it wasn't something that you bring up. I was obviously I'm autistic, and I was autistic my whole life, and we're pretty sure my mother is, even though she'll never at this point get diagnosed. But so she raised me and taught me a lot of the coping techniques or a lot of the ways of working through life as an autistic without knowing that that's what she was doing. But it's also why I wasn't diagnosed till adulthood, because she wasn't going, why is my daughter so weird? She was like, this is what I expect my daughter to be. she's exactly what I thought, a robot. And so it wasn't... She very much taught me how to hide those things in order to be socially acceptable.
Right.
And even now, it is only very recently that I think it's been all right to say, I have this condition, I need some extra help, or can we make some adjustments in the workplace so that I can do my job? And I'm still very hesitant about that. I know that it's in vogue right now to wear your uniqueness on your sleeve, and I'm very admiring of everybody who can do that, but I'm so highly trained to not let it get in the way of doing my job that it's still not something that I openly talk about easily.
Sure.
Because of how often it can just blow up in my face. And of course, when it blows up in your face, you go, I should have told you I was autistic sooner. But I'm not as practiced at being able to say, hi, I'm autistic, and I struggle with this, that, and the other. Because it feels, I've been made to feel like that is weakness, or it is just, I'm just basically handing producers an excuse to go, yeah, maybe this show isn't for you, we'll try somebody else. Because we don't have an HR in comedy. There's no HR department that you can go to and say, excuse me, I think I'm being discriminated against. No. Because comedy is subjective, and therefore everybody picking you or not picking you for a show is, they don't have to justify that. You can't go to have I Got News for You and go, why aren't you using me this season? You can't. Because they have so many good reasons to try all the plethora of people that are out there to try.
Yeah.
There's never, but it could be, well, last time we used her, she was a bit difficult. And so I never wanted that to be the reason.
Sure. And on Stuart Goldsmith's podcast I was listening to, you were talking, you talked about you as yourself and your stage persona as almost as if they're two different people. Is that something, do you make an a distinction between you off stage and you on stage, or is it sort of? I just think it's kind of interesting. They're clearly, as all comedians are to some degree, not themselves on stage, one would hope.
Yeah.
but for most of them, but is that something that you've consciously worked on, or is it just how it's is coming on stage? Is that a way of being a different person?
Well, as you said, we're all exaggerations of ourselves in one way or the other. Some people are clearly play characters. You mentioned in the dressing room, Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge, two separate people, two separate characters. But obviously, Alan Partridge can't be separated from Steve Coogan because he is nothing without Steve Coogan. And Rialina, it's because of how... Is anyone in the room neurodiverse identifies as? You don't have to. No? Okay. Ooh, the judgment.
They all definitely are. They just definitely are.
Hello. The way I've started explaining it is that the amount of energy it takes to put on all of the filters that come naturally to neurotypical, a lot of politeness and a lot of social interaction is something that neurotypicals can do without thought, mm-hmm. Whereas we do it we have to do it with thought. So we have to learn that or train that or learn how to do that. I still cannot answer the question, how are you, without stumbling, because my whole autistic being goes, well, how am I? Well, actually, this happened last week and I'm not feeling very well and I didn't sleep very well. And, you know, and then I have to go, no, they just want to hear something. And then I go, fine. And it's not the truth. And it hurts because it's not real and it's not what you asked. But why did you ask me if you didn't want to know the truth? But then this stupid thing of, how are you? Fine. Let's move on. Why did you ask? I hate that. You know, all of that. And the amount of energy it takes to put on these filters, I see it like shields on a Star Trek starship. You know, shields to the fore, shields to the aft. Shields are at 60%. And when I've run out of energy and I can't do that anymore, that's when you shrink back down to what is underneath that. Kind of like, okay, does anyone watch Star Trek or am I just on my own? Oh, thank you. Okay, so you know... You know how the doctor on Voyager is a hologram, and then at one point they go to the future and they get this portable hologram thing. I can't remember what it's called. So he was only able to work in the med bay because they had all of the hologram cameras that would make him a thing. But then when they got this portable one, he could go all over the ship and even go out because it would shine from within and create his hologram from within. And I feel it's a bit like that, is that the energy to project the social filters that I have that much energy, that's Riolina, and that's what I maintain, and that's what I have to balance the energy behind the scenes and go, okay, I've just filmed this, that, and the other 3 gigs, this podcast, 2 Just a Minutes tonight. I'm gonna have to take Monday off because I'm not gonna be able to shine those filters. And if I go out on Monday, I'm gonna be rude and someone's gonna be go, wow, what a bitch. when really all it is I'm completely broken as a shell. Sure. I don't know if I'm explaining this very well. Yeah, so the difference between Riolina and Ria. So Ria at home. First of all, Ria at home is a mom. I'm not going around cracking wise jokes and, you know, and heckling my own kids. so you know, you of course you are who you are at home. But I think that is a different person. The person that isn't Riolina wears a lot of elasticated clothing. Can I just say, you know, very much, maybe doesn't shower as frequently as Riolina either. I'll put that up in public. You all know what I'm talking about. You know, you go mom on a Friday.
Flannel over the balls. That's all you need. That's
right,
all you need.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, it's a jug by the toilet. Same thing. You know, so I try very hard to make sure that Riolina is, to the best of my ability, charming, easy to work with, professional, funny, all of those things. But behind the scenes, it is very much managing those things, and there's someone on the bridge sort of going, okay, aft shields are at 40%, watch out. But I now am able, so things I have been able, I do have someone that comes with me to studio now for pretty much every job unless there's a conflict, and she comes with me to every studio recording so that I have stability, so that I have the same thing, so that I can go out. And what I tell productions when they go, why are you bringing your own hair and makeup later? I'm like, she does do that. That's part of it, but that's not what it is. What it is, it's about making sure that when I leave my dressing room to do the job that you've hired me to do, that I will do that. I will do what you paid me to do, that you asked me to bring to the table. And bottom line is, if at the end of that job, if you don't understand or can't see why she was there, she did her job.
Right.
And that's the way to look at it.
Yeah. It's very interesting, but it's a lot of comedians are finding out or that they're
every
autistic
week. We should have a newsletter this week diagnosed with something neurodiverse.
Do you think there's something, you know, again, but is that something about, I actually did the tests, but I came out so normal that I was really upset because it doesn't explain me at all. I'm just pretending to be obsessive about stuff, clearly.
You can call that, if you want to call it something more, you can call it neurotypical.
Yeah.
Instead of normal, if you want to feel special.
I don't want to do that. I want to say I'm normal.
You want to say you're normal?
Yeah, but then can I say not mental? Is that all right? Is that better? Am I going further than... I don't know. I mean, what can you say? You can't say anything these days, can you?
That makes me abnormal and mental.
I take on board what you said, and I apologize.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I've always been mental, all right? I'm a complete nutshell, but that's totally separate to the autism.
You know, because obviously for a comedian to be a comedian, they have to look at the world in a different way. And obviously if you look at the world in a different way, or if the world is a different experience for you, that's going, you know, and is comedy... Do you feel comedy's a way to, you know, to use that for another purpose, if I suppose, is a way of saying. Do you think that's why so many comedians turn out to be neurodiverse? Or do you think being a comedian makes you neurodiverse?
Oh, this is a chicken and egg question?
It is.
I think they definitely were born neurodiverse. Yeah. I don't think that we don't do anything in the green room and then we spit them out and just go, welcome to your new brain, live with that. I think it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It makes sense that neurodiversity and comedy go together. Not that everybody is. I think that we have the full range of people in comedy, and I think that now, and I think that's the beauty of it, is that it's the one place. I think one of the reasons we're attracted to it is that comedy, especially now, is the one place where the more different you are, the better it is. And that doesn't apply to, I think, 98% of other workplaces, that if you walk in and go, I do things differently, my shelves are vertical, it doesn't work, and that can cause a lot of upset. And I think that's why we're now starting to talk about workplace adjustments for people that are neurodiverse, so that they can do jobs that they otherwise didn't quite fit into, which is great. But it is about seeing things differently. If we're not doing comedy, we're doing physics, because I think that's the other place where people see things that I can think. I'm just thinking about Einstein.
Yeah.
Einstein and the die in space. And you know, if you but die is a 3D six-sided object, and I remember him saying that all that's happening is you're seeing one side of the die, and you see the one, the four, and the three, and I'm looking at the other side, and I see a two, a five, and a six, and it's it's the same die though, but it, depending on which way you look at it, you're going, well, I see a sure. one, a two, and a six.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, we all look at the world in a different way, regardless of, you know. I think that's there's similarities, and I suppose comedy is so interesting because it can be pushing people out, or it can be drawing people in. At its best, it's hopefully drawing people in, and not, you know, and it can be aimed at someone, or it can be a community experience where you're coming together. So you're finding out your own weird differences and weirdnesses. By someone being honest about it on stage, I suppose. That's I feel like a lot of things I've done, when you talk openly about a subject like some testicles, you know, that people will then open up and talk about it, but they're normal people, normal non-comedian people, is what I mean by normal people, wouldn't... I think comedians aren't normal is what I'm saying, just as a general rule in lots of different ways. But basically, most people wouldn't talk about the things that comedians talk about.
Punters, we sort of
yeah,
punters.
Yeah,
if we're being Groffles. If we're in muggles, yeah.
Muggles. I mean, it's good. I think
we're tribal in our own way. Don't judge us.
It's good for people to. I've always found comedy quite therapeutic for myself. But I think by talking about your own mishaps and stupidity and problems, that it helps other people as well.
Yeah. That's interesting. I prefer to talk about other people's mishaps and stupidity.
But actually,
I'm working with a director who's like, can we talk about yours? I'm like, no. I don't want to talk about my mistakes. But yeah, no, that is true. And it's ironic, isn't it, that we're different. And yet it is. I notice that with some jokes. Every so often you land on a joke, or you say something that's a truth to you, and you try it out on stage and everybody laughs, and you discover through that, oh, you think that secretly too. Oh, and it brings everybody together in that way.
Yeah.
Every time I wished my husband was dead on stage and people laughed and went, oh, I'm not the only one who hates my husband.
And it's great when you do it and nobody... You say something that nobody identifies with. That's equally good, I think.
then you never say it again.
It really is just me on that one. I mean, God, there's so much to talk to you about, and we are running short of time. I mean, you've been doing so much telly, and I think you've not been doing quite as much stand-up as a result. Are you coming back?
I'm coming back.
More stand-up?
Yes. No, we're going to tour next year.
Right.
So touring next year in autumn, I think, and
okay.
I didn't pick that. My management management tells me what to do when I do it. That's pretty much it. They just go, you will do this. So I think we're touring next year, and the tour is called Reawakening.
Good.
Thanks.
Yep.
I'm fine. Thank you. So that
is it going to be a poster of you in bed going, and just wait, just that should be the poster.
You know what? I also see only one eye open, but we'll see what the rest of the poster is. I think that if I am, you know, in bed with not enough clothing on, then it'll be a very different audience that comes than I was expecting. So we'll, those will go on sale either later this year or beginning of next. And yeah, unfortunately, when you're like, you know this, you go and do a show, it's an all-day thing pretty much. Yeah. And then they spit you out at 9, 10 o'clock at night and you go home. So the gigging hasn't been happening as much, but I think we're picking it back up again. November, December, before I forget how to do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, but it's that can happen, and you're a fantastic stand-up comedian. You're so clever and you're so quick-witted. I think it's a really, and you work so hard. You work so hard on comedy. It's really impressive. You know, my generation are a very lazy lot of comedians who've got away with it. But people should come and see you live, even if they do watch you on the many shows we haven't talked about. There's so
you're
many
still
shows.
Here, and I think that counts for a lot.
It does.
It does count for life. Because when I started,
if you
were there.
If you don't give up, they have to let you carry. If you just
is that how it works?
If you're just persistent, they eventually just go, oh, for fuck's sake, let him do something.
It's the one thing in comedy that irritates me is that, not you personally, I don't want you to think that, but where people can identify as comedians if they just get on stage and do one gig. I'm a comedian. You see it on dating apps all the time. It's like, yeah, I do comedy. And then there's one picture of them doing the shittest gig on the circuit. And you go, I'm a comedian. And I have to say, I'm tempted when I see them to kind of go, do I swipe on them? And go, really? You're a comedian? What do you do? I get paid to be a comedian. But it is. It is the one thing where you can self-identify at whatever stage that you're at and never retire. There's no retirement age for comedy. I mean, there's some people that are definitely dead behind the eyes, but they're still going. They're still going.
I hope that people will, you know, it's a job you should only do if you're still enjoying it. There's no point in doing this job if you hate it. Though I think, you know, you're definitely right. It gets to a point where, I think especially if you start doing really well and making a lot of money and you're doing something, you know, that has gone on forever, then it's hard to walk away from it, maybe. But I think, yeah, I enjoy it more. The older I've got, the more I enjoy this job, really. So it's...
What else could you do, Richard?
Nothing.
Right. There we go.
I could have been a teacher.
Really?
If I started doing that. But now if I went into school and said, I've gone, hold on, aren't you the bloke who had a Hitler moustache for a year and did this joke about being wanking off paedophiles?
What could you have taught? Media studies. You could teach media studies.
I studied history. I mean, lightly studied history. I would have talked to
like Kwasi Kwarteng. You could be the next chancellor.
Yeah, could be him. I didn't do the history of economics. Yeah, I think I should be prime minister, actually, now. Now I think about it, I think I'll do that. Look, it's really lovely to meet you. You're going off to do two Just a Minutes and then going to Salford after that tonight.
Yes, to do Challenge.
Thank you for making space for us. Good luck on University Challenge.
Oh, you know what?
You're smart.
Well, no, but University Challenge is a level above. Like, there's people on there that know stuff, and I'm like, well, you're not going to be good at real life either because your head is full. Your head is full of crap you don't need. But I'm doing University Challenge, and they called, and they said, will you be team captain? I went, yes, I will, because then I'll look smart even if I don't know any of the answers.
Yeah.
I will say some right answers.
It's got to go through the captain.
Right, it's got to go through the captain. Except for the sports, that will be me nominating Ken Follett the time. I don't know.
Well, good luck on, and Just a Minute, good, fantastic show to be on as well. So, well, that for me, that was the one that when I was on Just a Minute, I thought that's fine
the
now.
The pressure of Just a Minute, you feel the pressure. When you walk in, again, there's people who've been listening to that since they were kids because it's the longest running show, I think. So that's another one where you go, I can't not do this justice or I can't disrespect this format by walking in going, so what do you want me to do? Chat shit for a minute? Yeah, I'm wrong. Because it's actually really hard as a comedian. We thrive on callbacks. Callbacks are some of the best laughs that you can get when you establish a joke and then later refer to it and everyone goes, oh my God, that's so clever how you brought that back in again. And so when I was, the first time I did it, I was doing this and then I do a callback. They're like, repetition. Damn it.
It's very hard. It's very hard, but it's very satisfying. And I'm delighted you're doing so well, and I'm absolutely certain it will continue. Go and see Ria's tour in 2023 and watch all of the TV shows that I haven't even talked to you about. So we'll have to get you back. Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Ria Lina! Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the Cheerful Earful for having us as well. Thank you. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Ria Lina. Thank you very much to Scant Regard, who provide the music for this podcast. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm indebted to George the Incompetent Soundman, who had done a reasonably competent job on this. Well, you judge what you think the sound was like. Thank you very much to everyone. Thank you very much to everyone at the Bedford in Balham. Thank you to everyone at the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival, which we were a part of. Thank you very much to Giles Gear, who organised it all. And thank you to everyone else who knows me. This is a Sky Potato. I'm Chris Evans. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Listen to another podcast now, not what anyone else is, one of ours. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. RichardHerring.com/ballback/tour or RichardHerring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStripe.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.